Good evening, and welcome to Compassion in Action, hosted by Hospice of the Valley of Northern California, Santa Clara University Department of Counseling Psychology, and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Dr. Dale Larson, Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ira Byock, Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, and author of The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Ira Byock.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure it is to be with you all. Thanks for coming out and spending this evening with me and our hosts and the community here in Santa Clara. It's remarkable that you would spend the time this evening to be talking about such a serious subject, and yet we have important things to do as a nation and as a national community. I want to give one disclaimer. You know, authors write books and then they go on tour to sell their book. I want to say very clearly that it would be more accurate to say that I wrote this book, The Best Care Possible, to give this talk. I mean that sincerely because I found a long time ago that if you have important things that you want to say into the culture, you darn well better write a book. Because nobody calls for interviews if you don't have a book. Your op-eds don't get any attention at the, you know, at the newspaper offices. And in fact, I think there's important things that need to be said into this culture, and really, time is running out for us to say it. In fact, we live in unprecedented times as a nation and as a national community. In very short amount of time, there's about to be more old people than young people on our planet for the first time in human history. And that's playing out in our country as well. We have extraordinary powers of medical science and technology that have never been available to human beings at any time in human history. And let me say now, and I'll probably repeat it, that that is a very good thing that we should not lose sight of. We're living longer than ever before in human history. Yes, much of that increase in our longevity is due to public health measures, sanitation, and the like, but many of us are living longer because of medical science. Nowadays, we are living for sometimes decades and often for at least years with diseases that used to kill human beings quite quickly. Congestive heart failure used to be a very sudden illness. The first time you got pulmonary edema, you died. Cancer was a subacute illness. Usually people would feel a lump in their axillary nodes or near their neck and their supraclavicular nodes, and then within just a few weeks they would be dead of either the cancer itself or more likely some complication of the cancer. Nowadays we're extending life dramatically. We have all this power of physiology and pharmacology and molecular biology and immunology and surgery, and, you know, we're living longer than ever before. Unfortunately, however, we have yet to make even one person immortal. What we have done is make it a lot harder to die than ever before. It seems ironic the first time you hear it, pretty peculiar, but the fact is that people are sicker now before they die than ever before in human history. Nowadays, we talk about the burden of disease. I mean, people live longer, but they live to acquire more and more effects of their illness. And that just makes it all very confusing for people. As a culture, it seems like we've learned that more treatment is always better. But of course, if you just think about it, since none of us gets out of this one alive, eventually more medical treatment for your disease must not be better care for you as a person. At some point in time, we have to look at the whole person perspective. Now, I'm a practicing physician, and sometimes people object to that sort of analysis. They push back because, you know, these days we're savvy consumers. I've had a person even recently say to me, well, yes, Dr. Byock, but you don't understand. My grandfather is like a cat with nine lives. He's gotten out of so many things. He was, you know, his plane was was shot during World War II, and he was able to land it and get out of that alive. All well and good. But I'm somebody who's seen some of those cats with nine lives. Have you ever? You know, they usually are limping on three legs. They've got patches of hair missing. They've got one ear down. It's not as if they get off, you know, without any effects of the traumas that they've been through. Because we're immortal, at some point in time, we have to define quality in a different way. The fact is that if you ask most people how you want to spend the last days of your life, the large majority of people, at least 70%, say that eventually they would like to spend their days at home or in a home-like environment, surrounded by people they know and love and who love them. In fact, about 70% of people die in facilities, in institutions, in either nursing homes or hospitals. And that figure of 70% is holding reasonably steady. Where progress is being made and fewer people are dying in hospitals, in general, in those regions, more people are dying in nursing homes. But the figure of about 70% stays the same. 20% of Americans still die in ICUs, the result of this assumption that more treatment is always better care. In fact, we have to get over this. Dying is hard. It will always be hard, but it doesn't have to be this hard. These days, I've been thinking a lot about imagination, of all things. Probably not something you thought I would be talking about tonight. But I find that imagination limits us in many ways and is keeping us from fixing the way we die in America today. Both individually, but also collectively, it's limiting us as a health system, as a society, and frankly, as a culture. Individually, when you or me or one of the people that we love is seriously ill, often the worst thing we can imagine is that they might die. But in fact, I know, because I've been doing this work for, well, over 30 years, and through some of the time that I've been in this field, I was also doing emergency medicine for years. For almost 14 years, I was doing emergency medicine. Partly it was to feed my hospice habit, because earlier in my career, you couldn't make a living doing hospice work as a physician. I know that there are worse things than having someone you love so dearly die. Most fundamentally, it's having someone you love die badly, suffering as they die. And maybe the only thing worse than that is sometime later realizing in retrospect that much of the person's suffering was unnecessary and could have been avoided. On the other hand, most Americans can't imagine anything positive associated with this time of life we call dying. I mean, it seems almost disrespectful to think about it. And yet I know, and so many of you who are working in the field of hospice and palliative care and healthcare in general know, that there are at times things that are highly valued that occur during this period of time when we would consider people to be dying. Things that have to do with their personal lives, with their relationships, with, you know, things that would have been left undone or unsaid that they deeply value. I've stopped using the phrase good death. I think it confuses us. For one thing, it confuses death, which is beyond life. I mean, death is a lifeless state, with dying, which is a part of living. It's that last chapter. I much prefer the term dying well, which I've tried to promulgate, because at least it conveys the sense of the lived experience of this difficult time of life. When you first hear the phrase dying well, the word well sounds like an adverb. Well, it is, you know, describing the process of dying or the person's experience of dying. But it's more challenging and I think more constructively provocative to hear and understand the word well as an adjective modifying the person who is dying. You know, can a person be well during the time that we consider him or her to be dying? Well, of course they can, because we're more than our bodies. And so if you just think about the most emotionally evolved or robust person you know, and think that he or she also will eventually face the end of life, there must be something about a sense of well-being that we can achieve that is, in fact, part of the human endowment. I think that collectively as well, we are limited in our ability to imagine anything of value during this time. Too many people think that it's all about suffering or its avoidance. You know, we think about the hospitals and places where people sometimes feel warehoused instead of cared for. The limit in our ability to care for people through the end of life is limited only by our ability to imagine how it might be better. How even the institutions, which frankly some of us will eventually end up in as we are nearing the end of our lives, how could we imagine them to be places of life, places that are vibrant, places that are, you know, encouraging of the human spirit, places that are filled with joy and, you know, laughter, as well as the poignancy of sadness, which is an inevitable and appropriate experience and emotion during these times. We can't imagine it, and so it's hard to get there. The reason that I have written books that are story-driven is because the stories are part of how we can stretch the realm of the imagination, the realm of the possible. I learned years ago, as somebody who, even as a child, was drawn to reading science fiction, that science fiction has important social cultural value for all of us. You can't, in so many ways, we were able to go to the moon because Jules Verne and H.G. Wells made it possible. They put it in our imagination. We were able to plumb the depths of the oceans partly because they made it something that we could at least imagine to be possible. Once the imagination accepted that this is within the realm of possibility, we could work together to get there. I chose the term, the idiom, the best care possible for this book because, in fact, it's the only thing I'm absolutely sure we all want, we all agree about. When we or someone we love is seriously ill, we want the best care possible. Of course, what that means is different from one person to another. This is a situation where one size definitely does not fit all. The best care possible, in fact, is highly individualized. It takes shared decision-making. Now, that's a term some of you may not know, but shared decision-making is at the very core of what we in palliative care practice. It is our intervention in the goals of care meetings with families or patients. We clarify a person's values and their preferences for care, and then we help them apply those values and preferences to the particular condition that they find themselves in, drawing on what we know about available treatments and achievable healthcare outcomes. Shared decision-making, therefore, always revolves around the person. It is truly at the center of whole-person care. A person's values and preferences are informed by their own history, but also by their, you know, ethnicity, often by their religion, and by their family. As we clarify their values and their preferences, we can then look at their particular medical condition, the set of diagnoses that they have, and the available treatment options, and then begin to weigh what may be of benefit to them against what are the known burdens of a treatment, as well as the risks, the potential burdens of a treatment. In years past, as I was growing up, I was born in 1951. I am solidly a boomer. As I was growing up and going to the doctor, shared decision-making happened when the doctor decided to share his decision with you. Nowadays, it's a genuinely collaborative process. And we're teaching, though not nearly enough, but we're teaching young physicians in training how to elucidate a person's values and preferences and collaborate with that person, often in the context of families, in finding out, you know, what works for them. I often think about this benefits versus burdens calculus as really being a balance beam. Looking at, again, it's not just benefits of burdens, it's the potential benefits of a treatment versus the known burdens and the risks. And that always takes place on a ground of the quality of life of the person. As the quality of life of a person begins to deteriorate, it may be that the balance beam inclines either toward treatment if there's so much suffering that any risk would be worthwhile, or away from treatment if the benefits or potential benefits come with too high a burden or too many risks. So the best care possible takes shared decision-making in an iterative fashion through the course of an illness. The best care possible also takes preparation. Now, this is a challenge in our culture today because you know as well as I do that people don't want to think about this. In fact, I've come to realize that the American mindset toward illness, dying, death, and grief can be captured by the exclamation, "I don't want to think about it." And I got to tell you, it doesn't get easier always as people get sicker. Sometimes the resistance to thinking about it just gets more and more intense. If I've learned anything in America today, it's that people don't want to be dead. And the truth is that doctors don't want their patients to die. So we all don't want to think about it. It's remarkable because in our technologically, scientifically sophisticated society, it turns out that superstition is alive and well. Somehow we act as if we don't think about it, it's not going to happen. And in fact, as people become more and more ill, sometimes if you bring it up, it's almost a disloyalty. He brought it up. That means it's going to happen. Why did you have to do that? But in fact, if we don't think about it, it doesn't make us immortal. It just means that when dying eventually happens, we're less prepared, and it often happens in a way that's harder or at least less consistent with what we value and what we would prefer. 70% of American adults don't have these things called advance directives. People hate to hear about it. They don't like the parts of these talks where those of us in palliative care and hospice, you know, start to mention it. But in fact, this is something that is part of our modern life, and we all ought to be thinking about it. On April 16th, every year, this one as well, National Healthcare Decisions Day comes around right after you pay your taxes. It should be pretty easy to remember, right? You got taxes out of the way, it's time to talk about death. But not really. It's time to talk about what you would want. Advance directives get a bad rap, even in clinical circles. You know, doctors hate them. They say, oh, they're never specific enough. They never actually address the issues. I don't know why you keep talking about it, Ira. But in fact, advance directives were never supposed to be plans of care. They're not plans of care. They're not prescriptions. They're not do not resuscitate orders. They're not comfort measure only orders. They're none of that. What they are, in fact, firstly, is before a crisis happens, they're a planning tool to help a patient or family sort through these subjects and decisions that they've spent their life not thinking about. Secondly, for each individual, they're a way of projecting our caring for our families into a future time when our families may be left holding the bag, may be left struggling with decisions about our treatment and care. And lastly, when a crisis happens, if I'm in an ICU meeting room, conference room with a family, and they have an advance directive for their, you know, father who is seriously ill, I know that I can use that advance directive to help them to sort through these difficult decisions so that they are feeling a little less burdened as they make these difficult decisions, which feel indeed like decisions of life and death. I have an advance directive, not because I have a serious illness, but because I have a family. And I know that if I have a car accident later tonight and I have a head injury, my wife and my two daughters are going to struggle about the decisions about my treatment. I can't stop that. But what I can do is give them clear authority so that no ethics committee or judge has to get involved in making decisions about my care and our family's intimate affairs. And I can tell them what I think I would want in these circumstances so that perhaps their struggles will be a little less and the burden that they feel will be just a little lighter. The best care possible, of course, takes good doctors. Now, I want to defend doctors here for a moment. Doctors are caring, sensitive people. Doctors truly love our patients. We care deeply about our patients. We get very close to patients. We don't want our patients to die. But in truth, doctors don't practice at a high level in matters related to shared decision-making, counseling of patients through these difficult courses of treatment and through these difficult times of life, supporting families, communicating thoroughly, you know, having continuity of care, thinking ahead in an anticipatory way, guiding people through these difficult times. And I can't deny that. In fact, it's not because doctors are insensitive, but in fact, medical students weren't born knowing how to communicate and counsel people. They didn't learn it in grade school. They didn't learn it in high school. They didn't learn it in college. If we don't teach it in medical school and in residency training, it's no mystery why graduating physicians get out into practice and they still feel really awkward having these conversations. That's not okay. But I think, and I can say this now as a medical educator, I think we're at fault as a system of medical education. We are failing our students and setting them up to fail our future patients. And in so doing, we're not serving society, particularly the demographics of our society that is aging and increasingly have people living with 2 and 3 and 4 or more diagnoses of serious illnesses. We've invented chronic illness, in fact, in the 20th century. That's a good thing. But as I said, we live in unprecedented times. These days, we are still teaching as a mandatory requirement somewhere around 200 or more hours of obstetrics and prenatal care and labor and delivery and neonatology to every medical student. Yet just think about it. Very few physicians in practice deliver babies these days, and every single one who does has gone through a separate training program, postgraduate, in OBGYN or family medicine. And, oh, by the way, the last time I checked, only about 50% of the population was at risk for having an obstetrical experience. Studies continue to show that eventually 100% of Americans die. One day when I was teaching a medical school class of third-year students, where they brought all the third-year students back after rotations as a class, and I asked, you know, put your hand up if you're going to deliver babies, and about 6 hands went up in the room. So all of those people were going to do, you know, postgraduate courses, and I said, put your hands up if you're going to do end-of-life care, and just a few people put their hands up. I said, okay, now put your hand up if you're going into family medicine, internal medicine, geriatrics, oncology, cardiology, pulmonology, critical care, and, you know, every hand went up. I said, just leave them up for a moment because all of you will be doing end-of-life care. You're going to be caring for people who are seriously ill during the last part of their life. You're just not going to be doing it in a way that we've taught you to do it. And so we've got work to do. We need to have people who are medical students and physicians in training skilled in pain and symptom management, communication, counseling, advocacy within increasingly complex health systems. We need to teach them how to listen. We need to teach them how to be quiet within themselves so they can hear the voice of the patient. It can be done. We can train for this. I just can't train people in a lecture. you know, or giving them things to read. We have to train them with on-the-job training. We have to train them in simulation labs and in rotations where they spend some of that 200 hours could be split in half and go to training in hospice and palliative medicine and shared decision-making and the like. The best care possible, of course, also takes a functioning healthcare system. Oy, have we got work to do there? Now, I, for one, celebrate the American healthcare system. I love the prowess of medicine and the technology of treating disease. I use it in my practice every day, and I use it in my personal life. But in fact, America's healthcare system would be more accurately termed a disease treatment system. We're all about treating diseases and physiology. We know the pharmacology of treatments. We have more and more technology to bring to bear. But we are increasingly focused more on the disease and the organ systems than the persons living with them. And that's a problem. Our health system today demonstrably is fragmented. It lacks continuity. More and more people tell me they feel like they're falling through the cracks. We assume that more is better. More treatment is always better. And frankly, the reimbursement system is really broken and drives this fragmentation and drives reimbursement toward quantity rather than quality. The Affordable Care Act would make several changes that align reimbursement with quality and truly patient-centeredness and family focus. Quality is not just about survival. It's about subjective quality of life for the individual. It's about the quality of communication with one's physician and nurses. It's about quality of comfort, of management of person's pain, of support for people's families. It can be done. We have examples of excellent care that should point us in that direction. Part of the reason that I tell stories in this book about what the best care possible looks like is, frankly, to raise people's expectations. I know full well that in raising expectations, I'm going to cause some frustration, and there's going to be people now annoyed, maybe frankly angry at the care that they're receiving because it doesn't look like the care that I describe. In fact, if you have any interest or a student of systems change, part of the process of systems change requires people being dissatisfied with the way things are so that they take action for their own self-interest and collectively perhaps take action together to fix things for the future. The best care possible, yes, will take a much better, more patient and family-focused health system, but it also will always take a family. You know that. And I mean family not defined simply by bloodline and marriage alone. Family these days is more defined, I think, by that phrase, for whom it matters. So often when we're told at Dartmouth-Hitchcock that we have a patient in the ICU who's unbefriended, you know, alone, we get in and come to know the person and we frankly snoop around a bit and find that, well, that person actually isn't totally unbefriended. And as long as you use that phrase, for whom it matters, as a guide, you can find almost always people for whom this person matters and who matters to him or her. That, in palliative care and hospice care, we focus on the person with his or her family as a unit of care. And in fact, that is the unit of care. I look at family more as the word family, more as a verb than a noun. Family has to do with belonging, with mutuality, with mutual responsiveness, with taking care of one another. Families are incredibly important. When people sometimes ask me, you know, Dr. Bayak, I'm only 45 years old and I'm worried about the future. What do you think I should do to prepare? I often say, if I were you, I would get myself a family. And if you're lucky enough to have one, well, then invest in your family. This is a good time to work on clearing up those relationships, you know, tightening those relationships, mending and tending and nurturing the relationships that really matter most. Families are the backbone of caring in America today. Over 61 million Americans are engaged in caring for a relative or friend who is ill or debilitated. 42 million Americans average over 18 hours each week caring for families. The best assisted living arrangement known to the human species is called marriage. Really, married couples are the best arrangement there is. You know, where there is an elder gentleman who has caring needs, let's call him Harry, usually there's a Shirley helping to care for him. Harry may have Parkinson's disease, maybe a little early memory loss, some arthritis, some heart failure. Shirley may have hypertension, diabetes, macular degeneration, osteoporosis, maybe a little spinal stenosis. I say this because it's so common, and yet, you know, the balance there is delicate. And as a society, if we were to support Harry and Shirley in caring for one another, it would be the best care possible and also would be highly efficient. But nowadays, we force them to have an acute medical problem to really respond to their needs. If Harry falls and hurts himself and ends up in the hospital, we'll care for him. But before he fell, we don't do an assessment of safety in the home, you know, and get rid of those throw rugs and make sure there's railings on the walls and the steps and in the bathroom. And frankly, we don't support either of them so that both of them have caregiving burden that lessens their quality of life and increases their health risks. These days, caregiving is in fact a diagnosis unto itself. Caregiving takes a toll on families, on caregivers. It takes a burden on their health, a burden on their mortality risk, which has been shown, and a financial burden, often draining people's bank accounts, often leaving families bankrupt in caring for a loved one. Caregiving is hard, but it doesn't need to be this hard. We're making it much harder than it is. The best care possible not only takes a family, it also takes a community. Here, I think community, like family, is also a verb. It has to do with mutuality, mutual responsiveness. You know, if you don't have a family and you're worried about the future, get yourself a community or more than one. In my experience, and I know my colleagues in palliative care and hospice will bear this out, people who are involved in faith communities often have a leg up on those who don't. It's not the religion or the spirituality solely, it's belonging. It's a sense of mutuality. You know, within a community, your well-being and other people's well-being are related. If you don't have a faith community, how about a workplace community? How about a neighborhood that actually is responsive to one another? Apartment complexes in large cities are often have the sense of community, or service clubs like the Lions or the Rotary, or you know, even bowling leagues can have a sense of community. 4-H in rural areas, I could go on and on. Communities are important. They improve the quality of people's lives, but they also have this sense of your well-being matters to me. And yes, it's always a burden to support somebody who's ill, but that burden is a lot lighter if it feels like you're doing it because it is satisfying to you to care for someone within your community. And then, of course, the best care possible takes love. There I said it. It's challenging for a doctor these days to talk about love and the importance of love in care. But, you know, love has always been the initial impetus of the caring professions of medicine and nursing and all the caring professions. And it is the driving force within our professions even today. Within our culture, we know that the epitome of excellence in care is captured by that phrase, tender, loving care. There is nothing unwholesome about love in healthcare. People think it's somehow, you know, well, I'm not sure that's okay. I mean, did you hear what he said? He said he loves his patients. Somehow I think it brings up some, like, sexual connotations. How bizarre is that? It turns out, and I've looked this up, love is wholesome. It's okay. It really is. It's a good impulse. Love is not unethical. Let me read a quick story about love. I mean, before I do, let me just say, in healthcare, love is not just about our individual attitudes, like, you know, like a New Age kind of philosophy, like we love our patients, like the lighting in a room where we radiate love toward our patients, or the temperature, you know, we love our patients here. Although we do it in a way that people can feel it when it's authentic, when it's not forced. Loving care can also take the form of complementary or integrative therapies, massage, Reiki, music, expressive arts. We have a writer who works with patients to pull poems out of them or stories out of them, helps them write letters. We have volunteers who visit just to lighten people's days, to read a newspaper to them, or, you know, just sit with them. Hard-boiled cynics may scoff at my alleged naivete of talking about love, having spent nearly a decade and a half working in emergency departments where cynicism and dark humor are as ubiquitous as dark coffee. I can understand their doubts. In this situation, however, cynicism is not warranted. I regularly invite journalists and policymakers to spend a day or two with our team at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, and I've seen jaded agency administrators and politicians and journalists melt when they see loving care in action. Seeing a terminally ill patient laugh while reading the newspaper with one of our No One Alone volunteers, glimpsing a nurse humming as she gives a debilitated patient a bed bath, as if the purpose of the act was to cause pleasure and the person was coming clean merely as a byproduct. Witnessing a person in pain fall gently asleep while having his foot massaged. Attending our morning clinical huddle, which we meet every morning as a team, and hearing us wrestle with strategies for relieving a person's pain, but also working with a family to help a family honor and celebrate a person who is facing the end of life. Well, not more than a year ago, a politically conservative state legislator was spending time with our team during a week where we were helping to care for a patient I'll call Mrs. Gold. When I met her, Mrs. Gold had been in the hospital for 9 days and in the ICU for 7 of those days, a victim of insidious pulmonary hypertension and pulmonary fibrosis that had caused no symptoms for years but had been damaging her lungs and heart for all that time. Now, at age 78, she needed mechanical ventilation to breathe, but she steadfastly refused to have a tube put in her throat. Indeed, and instead, she was fitted with a BiPAP mask tightly wrapped on her face that blew oxygen-enriched compressed air through her nose and mouth and into her lungs. She could speak in short, well-planned sentences if the bypass mask was removed for a few moments, but she mostly communicated by gesturing expressively with her hands and eyes. She had no trouble at all conveying that she was not happy. She told me in one breath, "I don't want to live like this." We were able to make her comfortable with small doses of morphine. She was alert, not suffering, but she was ready to die. She had raised 4 daughters and 2 sons after her husband had died when she was just 38 years old. As the matriarch of her large family, she wanted to make sure that her family understood and accepted her decision to die gently and was willing to hang on. She was willing to hang on for a few days for their sake so that they could adjust. Her children and spouses and her many, many grandchildren ached at the thought of losing her. Ultimately, however, each one supported her decision not to be intubated and put on mechanical ventilation. During one of those several meetings with her family, a daughter in her 40s spoke for the assembled group in saying, "We're as close as any family could ever hope to be." Overnight, her family transformed her ICU room into family space. There were at least 30 photos hung around her ICU room, including one of her own mother as a bride. She was never alone. Usually there were 2 or more family members visiting Mrs. Gold. Her pastor visited every other day. I was present on the Saturday afternoon when the BiPAP mask was removed. We gave her small doses of medication so that she would not be in distress. She was sleepy, comfortable, and awake. There was never a hint of distress. The last thing Mrs. Gold saw in this world were the faces of her 6 children and 2 of her grandchildren, each touching a part of her body, each smiling with tears in their eyes, each saying something like, "We love you, Mom." One said, "Tell Dad we send our love." These sorts of gentle, loving, end-of-life experiences happen fairly commonly in the homes of hospice patients. In reflecting on the case, I realized that in the minds of most people, ICU treatment and hospice care are like polar opposites, almost the antithesis of one another. And yet, no longer is that the case where I work. Every few months, it seems, we celebrate a wedding in the ICU or conduct a renewal of vows in the hospital's chapel before somebody dies. This is exceptional, but it's not rare. On that Saturday, I was glad that I was being shadowed by 3 second-year medical students. They stood beside me as Mrs. Gold died and witnessed what good end-of-life care looks like in an ICU. The following Monday, I called the legislator to report how Mrs. Gold had died. He agreed that her experience was illuminating, and then he said, "Well, that's all great, doctor, but there isn't a program like this everywhere." True enough, but my question is, why not? What's stopping us? I frankly think as a national culture, we've been pinned down by the culture war for too long. We can't talk about how we die in America today because it's become toxic. It's become radioactive to talk about it to politicians. They don't want to talk about it at all. Because on the one hand, they have to think about, well, this is going to lead to a discussion of assisted suicide. On the other hand, they're worried about death panels and killing granny. I got to tell you, this has gone on long enough. From this point on, tonight, I want to say very clearly that the branding of the terms dignity and pro-life are both null and void. I'm taking them back. For too long, we've been unable to talk about the terms dignity and pro-life without it sounding like a political culture war. In fact, I'm proudly pro-dignity and proudly pro-life. So are every other member of my field. So is the vast majority of Americans. In fact, I've come to believe that the cultural chasm in America today is a mirage. It turns out that we all stand on a plateau of high common ground between these warring factions. I mean, think about it. In any movie, or actually nowadays in reality, when a natural disaster strikes, when, you know, an earthquake happens, when there's a tornado, a flood, a tsunami, what happens? People come together. People of different ethnicities, religions, languages, colors of skin. We come together to work together for our common good. Ladies and gentlemen, death is the natural disaster that awaits us all. Despite our differences, and honoring our differences, continuing to argue about the issues that are worth arguing about, we can work together to fix the sorry state of dying in America today. Let me suggest, as we begin to close, some things that we can do together right now to fix this issue. For one thing, we can change and need to change the staffing in our nursing homes. We need to raise staffing in our nursing homes to at least a safe and prudent level. If you want to be pro-dignity, then there has to be enough people in nursing homes to answer a bell if your grandfather or grandmother needs to get to the bathroom or is wet and needs to be changed. I believe that people are inherently dignified, but they can be made to feel undignified if they are treated in an undignified fashion. The challenge of healthcare today in representing society and the challenge of our culture is to ensure that people's inherent dignity is honored through the end of life. People ought to be able to see their dignity reflected in our eyes, to feel dignified by the way they are cared for, not just clean and comfortable, but honored and celebrated, even pampered during their times of debilitation. That much we can do. Secondly, we need to formally recognize the rights of family members to make decisions about medical treatments for their relatives. These days, in many states, there are laws that take away those rights from relatives unless they have advance directives. Now, I just said I'm all for advance directives, but for the 70% of Americans who don't have them, we shouldn't have mandated government treatments, which is what effectively is happening through some of the laws that have taken away the rights of family to speak for others. Thirdly, we need to require, actually demand, that medical schools begin to teach the last stages of people's care for the last stages of people's lives on a par with the curriculum time now devoted to perinatal care, prenatal care, childbirth, and neonatal care. Requiring physicians to demonstrate knowledge and pain management as part of licensure examinations should be de rigueur. We cannot afford to graduate and license yet another generation of physicians who lack basic knowledge and skills in palliative care. And lastly, I'd say we need to dissolve the Medicare rule that forces people to give up treatments for their disease in order to receive hospice care for their comfort and quality of life. This rule has no basis in clinical principles. It has no basis in ethics. It is solely imposed by a Medicare statute. We now know that it does not save money. It actually costs more money to force people to give up treatment in order to get care. I think that something along the lines of a social movement is needed. We boomers may be older, but we are still the me generation. We still question authority, and we want only the very best. So let's have it. You know, let's have the best care possible. When we boomers were having babies, we took back the beginning of life. We started the natural birthing movement. When I was growing up, fathers weren't allowed in delivery rooms. And the medical profession worried that if we did, they would fall over and hurt themselves. Birthing coaches were not thought of. Nowadays, look what's happened in just a few short years. Now we worry if fathers don't want to come into the birthing rooms. We worry if a woman doesn't have a birth coach. What we said at the time was, the fact is that pregnancy and childbirth require expert medical attention, but the need of medicine and nursing does not define this experience as being primarily medical. It's fundamentally personal. Those words apply very well to the end of life. Our seriously ill and dying loved ones require expert medical and nursing attention. But dying is not fully medical, it's only partly medical. It is fundamentally, profoundly personal for the individual and family. It's time, ladies and gentlemen, to take back the end of life. Indeed, a social and cultural movement is needed. We should not lower our expectations or settle for anything less than the best care possible. Together, we can push on the leaders in medicine and nursing, our medical and nursing education system, our insurers, our policymakers. All of us need to say loudly that we want excellent medical care for those who are seriously ill and dying, but we also want tenderness and love. That, I think, is our great challenge and collectively our remarkable opportunity. Thank you for listening, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with me tonight.
Thank you, Ira, for sharing your insights with us and that inspiring and hortatory call to action. I'm just kind of quivering, really. We have a number of questions from our audience and students. So let me begin by asking, one person writes, will you be my end-of-life doctor? And I'll second that.
But you look so well, Bill.
Please comment on the Affordable Care Act, whether or not it should be passed or upheld or any comments on it at all. It's kind of a tough question.
Well, I'm actually waiting for the Supreme Court justices to give me a call and ask for my opinion.
I wish they had.
I certainly wish they had. I think that there's much in the Affordable Care Act to be supported, frankly. I think it particularly helps those of us who are worried about how people are cared for through the end of life is in promoting this notion of accountable care organizations. That's the thing that begins to shift payment in healthcare and align what we pay for with real quality from the person and family's perspective. And that's very different. When phones still had dials and doctors' offices were the de facto medical system. We developed this thing called fee-for-service healthcare. You paid doctors for doing something. But that has persisted. And throughout now modern history, the more a doctor does, or the more a local health system, a hospital or, you know, facility does, the more they get paid. That doesn't align what's really quality from the person's perspective, which has to do with communication and continuity, prevention of complications of a serious illness, and planning, including planning for how we can leave this life gently. All of that begins to become at least possible within the accountable care organization. It doesn't limit people to treatments, but it does begin to make the sorts of things that I talked about of shared decision-making and that individualized, meticulous process of finding out what people's values and preferences are and applying that to their condition and achievable health outcomes part of the way healthcare would be delivered. I think that that is something that has had bipartisan support until the most recent act made it a political football. And really, it's hard to imagine that is a partisan issue, that's something that most health service researchers think looks like progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really make a beautiful point that talking about dying won't kill you and that you need to talk about it
right, to
die well. My brother says he wants everything done to keep him alive. He has a living will that states he wants everything, with no limits at all. Being in an ICU is okay. What would you say to him?
Well, for one thing, if that's what he wants, it's not hard to get that today in America. I mean, that's really the default. And so he should really take comfort in knowing that he's going to get that as long as that's what he wants. I do think, however, that as your brother... as your brother's brother or sister, you ought to be cautious about being his proxy, because since he's still mortal, it's at some point in time going to be really hard to be consistent with those preferences. If I was his proxy, I would want to be sure that I knew something about when it would be okay to say enough is enough. You know, how far do you need to go to feel that you've honored his values and preferences? And that would be a way for him to both be explicit with you, but also to support you in knowing, you know, how you can be loyal to him during these most difficult times.
Mm-hmm. Another question is, sounds like this is a call to action. Yes, indeed. What action do you want us to take?
Mm-hmm.
Is there an organization that you represent or want us to join?
Well, I don't have an organization that I'm here representing. I want people to begin to have this conversation, to make it less superstitious and less onerous, to actually talk to one another about how we would want to be cared for through the end of life, what matters most, and to support one another. Because as I said, you know, one person gets a diagnosis and a family gets an illness. And so if we're going to go through this together, which I think is some of the wisdom of the human condition, we need to know what each other would want and support one another. I think we all ought to be pushing on some of the organizations that we already belong to, like the AARP needs to get involved in this and really be pushing this progressive position. I think our professional organizations need to as well. But what is needed is a social movement, and all of us need to be involved.
Mm-hmm. A physician asks, do dying patients really need IV fluids when they can't swallow and are thirsty?
You know, I've cared for dying people for many, many years, and for you and I, before we're seriously ill, if we have thirst, it usually requires ingesting a volume of fluid that changes the osmolality or the concentration of solutes in our blood and has to do with receptors in our atrium of our heart and our carotid bulbs. For people who are seriously ill, that type of sensation almost universally goes away. If somebody says they're thirsty, who is, you know, within days of death, and we moisten their mouth and throat and ask again, are you still thirsty? The vast majority of people say no. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be distinguishing between what is discomfort from a dry mouth or throat and what is actually the sort of thirst that you and I might experience. In fact, the excess of fluids causes more suffering in dying people in general than not having enough fluids.
This next question really bears on imagination, which I think you just eloquently described to us as a key ingredient, expanding our imagination, at this need to do that. In your book, this person has read Best Care Possible, you talk a lot about imagination, both how it limits people in knowing what to expect and demand, and how you use it in your practice. It seems like an odd focus for a doctor. Why do you believe imagination is so important?
You know, after you have the basic scientific knowledge base and skill set, sitting with a patient, it's so important to use imagination. For one thing, I try to listen in a way that I can begin to imagine what the person's experience is like. We're like a tuning fork in that sense. And if I can come into what I've termed imaginative alignment with a person, I can begin to see the world as if I was looking through their eyes. I can begin to hear this patient's story as if I was the speaker. One, I teach students never to say to somebody, oh, I know what you're going through. You do not. But I can say, if I've taken the time and invested the emotional energy to do it, it's hard for me to even imagine what you must be going through. You know, that's an empathic statement, because I've actually taken the time to come into imaginative alignment. But then, once I'm there and I'm in sort of that tuning fork sort of resonance with person, I can use my imagination to imagine what something positive might be like. I can, frankly, and here's the sort of secret that is at the heart of the way I practice it, in order for me to be an effective clinician, I have to be able to imagine the person well, even if they are seriously ill. What would well-being look like during this time of life? What's left undone? What would be most important to them to have accomplished within their personal life before they leave this life? And so together, things get pretty creative when I can be in that imaginative alignment, and then together we can imagine the person well. That's therapeutics from my perspective at its highest. And frankly, it's the most energizing and satisfying part of my practice as a physician.
So that's what really informs this the end-of-life decision-making and the way you are able to assist people, that empathic attunement.
That's right. That, you know, I've done, as I mentioned, emergency medicine for years. I've saved many lives. I've done CPR and crash intubations and all of that exciting, you know, stuff just like on TV. It's great fun. And as an adrenaline junkie, I loved it. But this is more exciting by far than anything I've ever done in the emergency department. This is real doctoring at its best.
It seems like you're talking about really helping people take advantage of the window of opportunity, whatever does exist for them.
That's right. That's right. We're all, you know, we're all going to die, but we can fulfill the highest promise of the human condition by caring for one another in this realm and in together helping people to die well.
One of your quotes from one of your earlier books, Dying Well, I believe, that's always really meant a lot to me and has been important, is the touchstone of dying well is the sense of growing in the midst of dying.
I think, you know, for me, I think like a developmentalist, you know, Maslow, Erickson, Piaget, they all focused on early childhood or young adult development, but they all said that human development is a lifelong process. I've tried to help people grow up, grow old, and eventually to grow on.
Well, that's been such an incredible contribution to the end-of-life field, in my opinion, that we haven't previously really thought about it that way, that there's a tremendous opportunity for growth at the end of life, and you've really made us all really think about that and start to practice in a way that makes that possible. Is it possible, someone asked, to teach professional healthcare providers to celebrate life in the dying process?
Yes, it is. But I can't do it with a lecture. I have to have them come and spend a week or two or three with our team. In so doing, they find that we can do the best physiology and pharmacology while also honoring the fullness of the human condition, honoring and celebrating people through the very end of life.
When I see what you're doing with your team there, I think, gosh, he's been able to really bring hospice care into a palliative care setting, into a hospital setting. Your interdisciplinary team meeting, which I had a chance to observe once, is profoundly like the interdisciplinary team
Sure.
meeting in hospice. And one part of me is thinking, how do you do that, and how can other medical teams achieve that kind of interdisciplinary focus, that whole person care that you've been advocating for so long?
Well, it takes, you know, strong vision and leadership. I'm blessed by having leadership at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, which actually gets it, which understands that good health care doesn't have to be solely focused on treatment, that good health care takes care of whole persons and families, and that doing the right thing in this day and age actually is both clinically effective and, frankly, cost-effective. So we've actually been supported in integrating ourselves within the very fabric of, you know, the acute care system, critical care, oncology, cardiology, hospital medicine. It turns out it works clinically, therapeutically, and is cost-effective.
You made the point that the healthcare system is broken, that it's not much about health, it's not about caring, it's not much of a system, to maybe summarize quickly.
Right.
But so you're fighting against that. We're all fighting against that, people in end-of-life care, to try to grow whole-person care and the kind of care you're talking about, the best care possible.
That's right.
In a system that militates against that in a lot of ways, like with empathy in terms of the amount of time you have with your patients. When we look at advanced directives with patients, advanced directive discussions are usually, I think, 5.9 minutes, and the physician ends up speaking for 80% of the time. And that's not because that's what they want to do. It's because it's what they have to do. So I think that there's a huge challenge here to either be a one-minute, you know, empathic physician, or to find another way to make this happen. I'm just kind
you know,
of reflecting
systems
on.
Can change, and I've learned that people do want to do the right thing. There's no ill intention. The system is broken, but there's no ill intention I can find anywhere through any stakeholder in the system. I think we all can imagine another way to do it. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that I've written this book is to put out there images and stories that can stretch the imagination to actually give all stakeholders a way of reimagining how we might do this better. It turns out that that's the biggest limitation, and I've learned to change systems. The most effective systems change is making the right way the easy way. So it doesn't fall just to the doctors or just to the nurses or just to the patients and families, but the system, as it's re-envisioned and reinvented, can help all of us do the right thing, to have the conversations, to think proactively, and then to stay focused on whole persons and families. It turns out success can happen that way as well. Nobody needs to give up on their stake in treating disease. We all can treat disease aggressively while caring for people tenderly and even lovingly.
That's inspiring. The idea is that people really know what's the best thing to do. It's just that they have to overcome, see beyond the kind of system
That's right.
constraints.
Yeah. Yeah. The system has to change to allow us to do what we feel and know is right.
This kind of takes us in a different direction, but it's an interesting one. Do you think that the advent of social media, texting, computerization, EMRs, et cetera, has harmed communication, or does it present an opportunity for better communication with the younger generation?
Oh, I think it's the future. I mean, the idea that we're still writing on paper and can't communicate our notes or test results to other physicians who are seeing the same patient is really, it's hard to imagine that we've come to the 21st century and that's still the case. We wouldn't tolerate it in any other industry. Why do we tolerate it in healthcare? It doesn't need to be a barrier. It can be a help. I do think that the sort of spreadsheet charting that we're doing these days is challenging. And, you know, so many of us are eager to support narrative medicine of telling the patient's story. This is something that we're challenged by in our own practice at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, the palliative care team. We're trying to use the electronic medical record because there are real advantages to it for quality improvement and for communication to other clinicians, but we're also trying to still put in the patient's story, to do enough narrative medical charting so that the authentic experience of the person and the person's richness as a human being is not lost in this sort of spreadsheet charting that the EMR, the electronic medical record, is trying to push us all to do.
Yeah. There are so many forces like that. You have to find a way to keep care, the best care possible, as the focus from in all those situations. Here's another more personal question. Have you gotten emotional when a patient died? Person writes, I think the emotion that comes when someone dies is because of sadness and not necessarily because they don't accept death. Please comment on it.
Well, yes. I'm often sad when people die. I really come to know the persons that we care for, so many of them. I know their story. I know their family. Sometimes I know their parents or their children. And yes, I definitely, that imaginative alignment I was talking about means that it hurts. The very word compassion comes from the old Latin, to suffer with. And that's part of what the cost, if you will, of caring is. I would have to say, though, that it's not just a spending of our emotional energies, that I also often feel filled up by the relationships I have with patients, that it enriches my life by knowing people. And I also, empathy swings both ways. I mean, compassion is part of empathy, and you hurt when people hurt, and you're sad when they die. I also feel joy at knowing people, and I celebrate the good times and the successes that we often have during the course of an illness. And it enriches my life. This doctoring thing is really a wonderful profession and very, very rich and rewarding work to be doing. I teach physicians in training to bring their whole self to the clinical encounter. Mm-hmm. If you're not there, fully there, then the many hours that we put in our profession begins to be a very sparse life. You know, if you're always sort of aloof and never involved really personally, then, boy, those hours are long hours. So I bring my whole self there, and I, enjoy the interaction. I kid and kibitz with patients and laugh with them. But I also feel sad and tearful at times when bad things are happening. That's just part of full and healthy doctoring.
Yeah. It really brings home the point that we often think altruistic and egoistic motivations are in conflict with each other, but maybe we become all that we can become through caring for others.
We're investing a lot of our energy and ego in service of other people, yeah. And that pays rewards.
Dame Cicely Saunders said, be yourself as a helper. Carl Rogers said, be genuine, authentic. It seems like that's a big part of what you're really saying to us. And it's such a big, important part of what we do when we're effective with people. You mentioned love, and you were kind of hesitant, how, I'm not supposed to be talking about love. And I was thinking of one of my other heroes, Carl Rogers, who in one film said, in the best moments in therapy, there is love. And I know he was really given a hard time back in 1950-something when he talked about love in psychotherapy. That's all countertransference.
Yeah, no, of course.
But I'm glad you did.
He was so right. The fact that we've become reticent to talk about love is talk about not acknowledging the elephant in the room. It turns out it's a good thing. It's really pure. There are boundaries to our actions, but the emotion of what did he call it? Positive regard, right? Unconditional positive regard. That's exactly it. And if that's not wholesome, I don't know what is.
question about the field. Hospice and palliative care have grown dramatically in recent years. Is that because they save money?
Well, you know, in fact, it sort of is. I mean, if they're the right thing, they are better care. But if they didn't save money, it would be really hard to do it these days. In fact, money drives a lot. And we have a health system that nowadays is topping 17% of our gross domestic product. Fully twice the next highest spending developed country in the world. We're not getting our return on investment. We don't need to put more money in the last, you know, year or 2 years of life. We need to get more value out of the investment we're making. So, in fact, it would be hard to be doing these sorts of team-based interdisciplinary care for people if it was costing more. Thankfully, we're spending so much money and in such a scattershot kind of only looking at the disease, only giving more treatment, that we can actually substantially improve quality of people's care and quality of their lives while spending less money. In fact, we almost have to spend less money to do it better. And again, research has borne that out. So in a sense, we've grown. It just so happens that in this case, doing the right thing is cost effective. Thank goodness it is. But it is part of why hospice and now the field of palliative medicine is being so well embraced, because hospital administrators and politicians even are seeing that quality goes up and costs actually go down. Thankfully, that's driving some of the dissemination and expansion of this field.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question. What's the difference then between hospice and palliative care?
You know, in America, palliative care grew out of a hospice base. I was in Fresno, California in the late 1970s and early 1980s when hospice was just a countercultural movement. Really, it was started, frankly, by nurses, who should get the lion's share of credit for really driving the field of hospice care in its early stages. We were meeting in church basements and schools after hours to organize this social movement called hospice care. It was a response to people dying badly, mostly in hospitals, too often in pain, too often alone. Hospice care grew and developed because in 1981 a statute was passed that made Medicare begin to cover this generous package of services called hospice care. But now palliative care has grown out of that hospice base. Hospice is still the best developed delivery model for palliative care. The problem with hospice care is that you got to be dying to get it. In fact, it's worse than that. In America, it's not enough to be dying to get hospice care. You also have to agree you are dying. And I got to tell you, a lot of the people I care for at Dartmouth are not about to do that. And you have to be willing to forego or give up treatments for your disease in order to get this comprehensive package for your comfort and quality of life and your family support. Now, palliative care has grown out of that, but we don't impose, in hospital-based palliative care, we're not imposing that either-or terrible choice on people. We're able to support them concurrently with aggressive treatments for their disease, bringing that same interdisciplinary team focus for their comfort and quality of life and family support through the course of illness. Thank goodness, again, that we're able to do this and show that costs, when we're involved, the costs per patient per day for people in an ICU or in the hospital is actually less than if we're not involved. So we're paying through, or we're compensated, quote-unquote, through something called cost avoidance. And because hospitals are already at risk under Medicare for the care of hospitalized patients, they can, if they find that we're going to improve quality while diminishing costs per patient per day, they're willing to support our team. In hospice care, we're kind of constrained by the current Medicare requirement, which does have to get changed.
Your book and your lectures and everything that you do is just such an eloquent statement for describing the new vision that you really want us to kind of get a glimmer of and expand our imagination. One of the things that we know is that if these examples of dying well are in the media or in soap operas, for example, uh-huh. Albert Bandura's yep. effort has found that can really transform the culture. I've always joked that I hope that Susan Lucci dies in hospice care. which startles my mother every time I say it. But as you think about this big challenge, which is changing the culture and increasing the sense of efficacy, I mean, this whole notion that you've introduced to the culture, I believe, more than anyone, that you can die better rather than less well, which is kind of a new idea. And you can die with a sense of efficacy even though you're dying.
Right. I think
that's a totally new idea.
Well, and again, you have to see it. If you've seen it, you know, you have a sense of, oh, yeah, that's what he's talking about. People can be well within themselves even though they're leaving this life. It's sad. It's hard. I don't want to romanticize or glorify any of it. Yeah. But it is possible within our human condition, our human endowment, to have a sense of well-being even as you are leaving this life. And I think really that is what we all should have in our minds and imaginations and strive for. We should accept, frankly, nothing less from the health system and our society.
One situation that, of course, tugs at all our hearts is the dying child. And this person, this is our last question, all we have time for. How is dying support different for children than adults with terminal illness?
You know, it's just in more high contrast. It's so poignant to sit with a child who is seriously ill. And it's hard, obviously, on not only the child, but their family particularly. But also one can see the doctors and nurses and the extended family of a child just cringing and convulsing almost emotionally. And yet every life is a full life. Every life has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And children do sometimes die. Without in any way diminishing the tragedy, we also can honor and celebrate the life of this person, their life, and the family, and support people during these inherently difficult times. These are difficult cards to play, and yet we have to be able to play them well and to, again, honor and celebrate people through the very end of life. That's what we should be doing as a set of professions and a caring society.
Well, it's hard to end because it's been such an inspiring time with you, and I just want to thank you for your inspiring ideas and the great work that you do.
Thank you, Dale. Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you.
My esteemed colleague and National Hospice Leader, Sally Attalus, President and CEO of Hospice of the Valley in Northern California, will close our program.
Thank you so much, Dale. I hope you've all enjoyed this evening's Compassion in Action program, brought to you by Hospice of the Valley in San Jose, California, Santa Clara University Department of Counseling Psychology, and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Ira Biok, Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and author of The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. And, of course, Dr. Dale Larson, Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University. Our audience here in Santa Clara, California, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned.